know what the topic was. Okay.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, and I'm here after Christmas.
With your co-host, Dr. Santa Phil.
Santa Phil with Admiral Haglund. Oh, yes. As it's known everywhere else in the Commonwealth, Boxing Day.
Today's Feast of Stephen. When's that?
January 12th.
Really?
I just made that up.
One of my favorite of the Christmas songs now is Good King Wenceslas.
Oh, yeah.
Good King Wenceslas looked out.
What the hell does that mean?
Feast of Stephen. Yeah, and I don't know any other words, and I love that song. I listen to it every time it's on, and yet I've failed to learn any other
line
words,
from
and
that.
And I don't know what it's about. And I
Who is King Wenceslas?
I don't know.
And why did
he was good?
And why wasn't he joining the Feast of Stephen? Why was he looking down on it?
Happy Feast of Stephen to everyone.
It's Boxing Day. Today's the day, the biggest shopping day in Canada right now. And also a day where you pack your gifts up you didn't like into a box and return them.
I'm bloated from pumpkin pie and eggnog.
Homemade.
And homemade bloating.
Delicious.
And I'm going to actually finally open your gift.
Yeah, you want to do that?
To me.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit later, maybe, in the show. So anyway, happy day after. And of course, happy New Year to everyone. We'll
happy
be
New
back
Year.
Next week with not a pre-recorded show.
Right, brand new.
Brand new, but our traditional New Year's resolution show.
The Feet to the Fire show, as I call it.
Where we look back at last year's resolutions and then take a look forward our new resolutions.
How well we accomplished anything.
And this year we're going to do something that we've never actually done before. And that is a special theme
show. A theme show.
Where we look at our favorites of 2011.
And sort of celebrate the positive things of the year.
Say goodbye.
Say goodbye.
And this is not best of. This is not top 10 films, television shows.
These are personal experiences.
Just our favorite
things.
Moments, memories, things of the year that was 2011.
Right.
Before we get to that, however, because we don't like to deal strictly in the positive on your Chilpak Hollywood Hour.
We are a balanced show.
We did have a couple of issues left over from last week and really from the week before that that we wanted to discuss. And so you won't be hearing this week or next week any of your new favorites, your Chilpak Hollywood lawsuits of the week, Chilpak Hollywood explanation of the week, Chilpak Hollywood wing nuts of the week. None of these things, but they will be making a welcome return in the second show of January 2012.
Can hardly wait.
2 weeks ago, you wanted to ask me about what was then kind of breaking news.
Breaking news.
Which was the Hollywood shooting.
Oh, yes, of course.
Where, for those who don't remember, Tyler Brehm, 26-year-old man, opened fire randomly on pedestrians and motorists.
And killed one guy, the music executive.
Death Row Records VP. And popular music producer John Atterbury died from wounds inflicted.
Got one in the jaw.
And this took place in the heart of Hollywood.
Ironically.
On Vine, just south of Sunset.
Right. Right by the Arclight Theater.
Exactly.
And the Academy of Motion Pictures Sciences is there.
The Pickford Center.
The Pickford Center.
Yeah. Where the Linwood Dunn Theater is.
Right. Thank you.
So you had wanted to ask me about this.
Yes, because it was said that this guy was reacting to a break of a relationship and that, as a violence prevention specialist, surely there is warning signs or something like that to indicate how and why this kind of rage is taken out in a public expression.
Well, first, in reading about it, one of the first things that struck me again, especially at this time of year, it's the holiday season, which is a season of high stress and tension, and things are speeding up more and more and more, not just year by year, but at this time of year. As you get towards the end of the year, things seem to be, you're just running out of time.
And it's a seasonal disaffective order as well. We run out of sunlight.
Right.
It gets darker earlier.
And one of the most important things in the violence prevention movement and education is to not demonize and vilify the word violence.
Yeah.
Okay. Violence is something that is inherent to all of us. It is part of nature. As I used to point out, with especially school children, right? Think about one of the events in the United States that motivated a redoubling of my efforts where violence prevention was concerned and educational outreach was concerned was Katrina. Because I remember watching those, you know, horrifying images on the television, and you would hear about, you know, roving rape gangs at the Superdome and people wondering what can we do? What can we do to help? And I was just struck by this idea that kind of we are all New Orleans. You know, any major city is one disaster away from something like this. And so I redoubled my efforts in terms of violence prevention and educational outreach in this city.
Right.
And it was a wonderful learning tool because I could show kids these clips, these news clips, where Katrina was being described again and again and again as a violent storm.
Right.
It was a violent storm. And indeed, it was.
Yeah.
Did Katrina mean to damage, destroy, kill?
No. Right.
That was what it did. So you separate the word violence from intent.
Ah.
And you get to a definition that can be meaningful given all range of circumstances, which is the definition we use in violence prevention. Violence is any act, energy, or force that injures, harms, or destroys.
Right.
It does not need to be physical.
Right.
It can be emotional.
It can be mental.
It can be verbal. It can be psychological. In fact, probably the most long-term damaging violent is psychological, is emotional. So that's the first thing that you do. So you realize that it is part of all of us.
Right.
It is part of nature. And therefore, it is incumbent upon all of us to create a less violent world.
Right. But you do that ironically by embracing violence, quote unquote, without making it a dark, vilified shadow.
Well, it is. That's part of it. Certainly, you don't deny it within yourself. What it is all about is making healthy choices.
Right.
Because what we know about humankind is violent reactions and violent choices, be they hurtful words, be they hurtful acts, be they physically abusive acts, are born out of feelings of powerlessness.
Uh-huh.
Anger is a response to powerlessness. Giving into that anger is a response to powerlessness. We try to exert control over people, places, events, when we feel powerless.
Right.
And so it's about learning healthier choices. That's what it is. You know, it's not that you don't have those feelings of powerlessness, but that you learn to choose
something that is not yet as destructive. Then.
And so you don't, again, demonize those that give in to these violent choices. You realize that, again, it's incumbent upon all of us to learn these healthier choices and to promote them. And so an experience like this in Hollywood is really fascinating to look at. It's horrifying, and it's far from a singular event.
Right.
And so you look at it and you say, well, what, almost like a dream, what can we take as larger messages from this event?
And one of them to me is the question of public mental health. To me, if this guy had, like, I don't know anything about his mental health situation, but it seemed that it wasn't healthy, that his mental state was quote unquote unhinged. And I don't even like that term.
Well, let's look at him. What do we know about him?
Right.
26.
Right.
Unemployed. Broke up with his girlfriend of 4 years the Tuesday before. Had been here a month.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Subletting someone else's apartment.
Oh, right.
So this person had absolutely no roots.
Right. No social connections.
No social connection. No community whatsoever.
Right.
This you know, going out and firing all these bullets into the street at pedestrians and automobiles. You know, Los Angeles isn't particularly the easiest city to create a sense of community.
That's true.
And yet the greater the sense of community and the greater the sense of involvement in that community, the less you find events like these.
Right.
So as a matter of personal safety, you know, foster a sense of community.
Right. It's true.
And this is a hard one for me because I have never been a good neighbor in the sense of getting to know my neighbors.
Right.
I like my privacy. I value my privacy a great deal. I do not...
Leave your door open and say, come on over, Joe, for a cup of Joe.
And this is something always for me to look at in these circumstances. I am reminded of that that condo explosion in New York where the entire building was taken down by a man's suicide. Remember he like put his head in the oven? And
yeah, the gas oven. The doctor did that. Yeah, that's right.
And all the neighbors, you know, were asked, and nobody in the building really knew him.
Right.
Nobody knew him. How often had people passed him and possibly seen or, you know, you never know. You don't know. But by the same token, you never know when being that one person who asks someone, hey, is everything okay?
Right.
Hey, you know, if you ever need to talk, I'm downstairs.
Right.
You don't know. There's no guarantee that anything like that works. When mental illness descends upon someone, when things seem that dark, you don't know. But there is always the possibility that one voice may come forward and say, hey, why don't you at least just go try and knock on that person's door?
Yeah, we haven't heard from them in a long time.
And that's a tough one for me to look at because, of course, I'm not that neighbor.
Right.
I like to think that I'm a good neighbor because if they need to rely on me, they can.
Right.
But if they don't know they're welcome to.
Right. And you like your privacy, like you said. I mean, if you open that, the doctor's in shingle.
Right.
Then that's the last time you can remember watch a movie.
So, you know, it's, and of course I do try to outreach and create community in different ways.
Right.
It's simply right there. I want my retreat. Basically,
totally makes sense.
But so that's an important one. I mean, this person clearly had none of it.
Right. And he just moved here, I guess, to get away probably from his girlfriend. If they were just broke up last. Oh no, there was a long distance relationship then at that point.
Yeah.
Right. That would make also some sense.
I find it interesting that the victim who died would be the vice president of something called Death Row Records.
That is some sort of bizarre irony way down.
Yeah, you know, and again, this idea of the messages that we give out in so many ways.
Right.
That the energy we give out is the energy that's going to come back to us.
Interesting.
And so it is this really horrible dream kind of that you look at from all these different angles. But I think the most important one again is this idea of, first of all, this idea of you know, we are all in it together, and you never know when being that voice of, hey, if you ever need anything to talk about.
Turns that around.
And then the question is, though, what do you do when someone does come to you with
going, I'm going to take a gun, I'm going to go stand out in the middle of the street.
Or when someone shares with you something that's happened to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this really important sacred role of witnessing without judging, without needing to do anything with it, without telling anyone what to do. Because whether it is someone who is living with violence in their life as because there are perpetrators perpetrating it against them, or someone who is actually perpetrating that violence, I guarantee you that either of those people have had enough of anyone in their lives trying to tell them what to do.
Right.
Right.
That's the last thing they need.
And so you need, in a very real sense, we all need, when we're witnessing in that way, to be the change we wish to see, which is to be okay in the powerlessness of not doing anything with the story that is being shared. with us.
Fascinating.
Just letting them know that they are seen and heard. There is no
That's a skill level.
There is no coincidence that we're talking about this at the end of a year when we've been traveling with The Truth Is Out There. And we see the gift that it is for people to know that they are seen and heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many people who might be strident in their point of view, who may be very dark in their point of view, a change comes over them energetically when they recognize that they are being seen and listened to by a fellow human being.
Right.
No matter how dark your worldview, it gets opened. It gets cracked open a bit because guess what? You actually can see another person and they are seeing you. The window shutter has opened. Light is getting in.
Yeah, right.
It has created a new possibility. There is a reason why Dr. Stanley Monteith in our film talks about how the war is coming and there is nothing but darkness all around.
Right.
At the end of the conversation, he is telling you that he's more hopeful than he's ever been.
Yeah.
Well, of course he is, because he is actually making a direct connection, and that direct connection will always lead to some sense of hope. Is it enough to overcome a lifetime of abuse, as we're talking about when it comes to violence? Probably not.
Right.
Maybe not. But you. But again,
it gives that sense of hope.
You're planting seeds.
Yeah.
And you may never know what crop will spring from that seed or whether it will take root at all, but it creates possibility. And that's what we all can be doing for each other is planting seeds all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's not a coincidence that we're talking about this in that year. I mean, I think about this with, you know, the whole label of conspiracy theorists,
right?
Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
And right.
Some people saying, look, there is no such thing as conspiracy. There's business as usual. Other people saying, well, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's true. It's not.
Right.
But I get the feeling when people label conspiracy theorists, there is this general sense. And I say this now after a year of, well, not only after making the film, but a year after showing the film, I get this sense that for a lot of people, because I'm always amused when people say, well, I'm not really into conspiracy theories. I'm not really into... But tell me.
Yeah, right?
Was the moon landing fake?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Everyone's got their thing.
Right.
But they won't identify as a conspiracy theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that there is a picture in most people's mind of the world that a conspiracy theorist inhabits.
Ah, right.
And there is a truth in this picture. Because...
To a degree,
if
yeah.
you... We do co-create the world we live in through the stories
that
we tell and that we choose to believe in. They may be factual stories, but we are co-creating the world. We live in that world. So if what we see, no matter how fact-based, if what we see is this dark, pessimistic, hopeless world, well, we are going to live in that world because that's what we are immersed in until other possibilities come our way.
Right.
And you do not illumine those possibilities for people by shunning them
right.
and pushing them to the fringe where things always get more dark and get more insulated.
Right. Shuttered.
By inviting people into the light of common discourse
mm-hmm.
and common decency. Then you open possibilities
right.
for them.
I'm reminded again watching the military channel and the history of World War II. I was surprised to see that when German prisoners were brought over, they weren't trapped in a Guantanamo Bay, kind of shuttered off on an island. They were, in fact, encouraged to work in the communities of America so that they would learn how great it is to live in this country. And in fact, it worked. A lot of the prisoners after the war emigrated over here and moved to America.
So what is it? Why is it that we feel the need to shun so many people, to push them to the margins? And for me, one answer, and it is one of my favorite moments of 2011.
Here we go.
A mother of several children wrote to me after our screening in San Jose
uh-huh.
about how she'd never had the courage to go see a conspiracy-related film before because she just could not afford herself the possibility that she would be plunged into darkness because she has the responsibility to instill a sense of hope in her kids. And how is she going to do that if she doesn't feel that?
Interesting.
And so she really loved the fact that we took her into the darkness without ever depriving her of a sense of hope or a sense of inspiration. And I think there's something to this. I think there's something to all of our knee-jerk reaction against the darkness of someone else's story.
Right.
Be it a conspiracy or be it a personal experience.
Yeah.
Because, oh, it's just too heavy. It's just too dark.
Can't hear that.
I don't want to hear that. I might go into it. Instead of recognizing life for being the constant and eternal and universal interplay of light with shadow, and that in those circumstances, when we do find ourselves engaging with darkness, we can be the light in that darkness.
In that darkness.
And
be the change you want to be.
Well, and this then is, you know, a really important thing, getting back to the shooter in Hollywood, or whenever we're encountering someone who is revealing to us some relationship they have with violence, be it, again, as perpetrator or potential perpetrator or as victim.
Right.
Or survivor, as we're taught to say
now. Yeah, right.
And not just now, because the idea, again, of a victim is one of identifying someone for what they've gone through.
Right.
Instead of saying you are a person no different than any other who has survived, perhaps, circumstances that are extraordinary in my realm of belief and understanding, mm-hmm. but we are all survivors of our own unique hardships, our own unique travails, our own unique pain, and this is what you have
accomplished.
Are in the process of surviving.
Right.
This might very well be the road that leads to your greatest triumph.
Right.
And I have seen no shortage of examples of that in my years doing violence prevention work of people who have not only overcome horrible acts and sometimes repeated cyclical acts of violence in their lives, but have learned to use that pain and that hardship to fuel their very accomplishments.
Right.
So, you know, when confronted with these, to have the generosity and the kindness and the openness and the strength to be able to witness this without needing to do anything with it, without needing to make it all right.
And without judgment.
To realize that energy that we embody is going to plant the greatest seed and is going to be the greatest offer, because it's what shows people that there is hope. It's not sitting with Dr. Stanley Monteith, Alex Jones,
Jordan Maxwell,
anyone talking about anything and agreeing with them.
Right.
It's about sitting there and listening to them and appreciating them for their uniqueness. And the gift in that is letting them have a glimpse, perhaps, depending on who they are, a rare glimpse of, boy, what a warm, welcoming place this world can be.
Well, who would have guessed that The Truth Is Out There is the perfect Christmas movie?
The Day After Christmas.
The Day After Christmas.
You know, I was struck apropos of this Hollywood shooting of two more... I think they were witnesses coming forth against Jerry Sandusky, the former football coach at Penn State, that show clearly that alleged acts of abuse and violence took place over at least a decade.
Right. A huge amount of time.
A decade in time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I find so distasteful is public reaction towards anyone, whenever something like this is exposed. You know, if I saw a guy doing that to a kid in the shower, I would have murdered him.
Right.
Right. So they, if I, you
saw
know, just
violence.
This act of this reaction of anger.
Of rage.
Of almost violence surrounding these circumstances. And I find them almost distasteful for the obvious reason that their reaction is born entirely out of powerlessness.
Right.
You yourself feel powerless. You keep hearing news stories about these things happening, and you yourself feel powerless
to do anything,
about it. And the truth is, we are all responsible. All of us are responsible for Jerry Sandusky. Every single person is responsible in some way. As long as we allow the culture that allowed these things to take place. As long as we allow the exploitation of children, of youth, we've gone on and on and on about this in so many ways. But there is also the very real sense that we are all responsible in that. For 10 years, this was going on. There were no shortage of witnesses.
Right.
There were no shortage of times when children told other people what was taking place.
And this is because of his power as a coach. I mean, this was a beloved coach who had won many games for the college and therefore had this power.
It is also about our creating a nation that does not bear witness.
Ah.
And this is, you know, why I bring this up with the story of how to be a good witness, how to be a better witness. You know, Herman Cain gets asked a question at a debate about sexual harassment, and the person who asks the question gets booed. Right? Those people are lying. Kobe Bryant gets charged with rape. The person who accuses him is a liar, is a whore, is all these sort of things. You know, sexual harassment, rape, child abuse, molestation can be falsely charged.
Uh-huh.
Of course. People can lie. We know this.
Right.
However, there's one thing not to ignore that all of these crimes have in common. They are all dramatically underreported.
Ah.
The vast, vast, vast majority of all of these incidents are never criminally reported.
I did not know that.
So the odds are not that the person is actually lying about it. It's that it's the tip of the iceberg.
Ah. Wow.
Clearly, with Jerry Sandusky, every single time anyone witnessed something or saw something, it turns out it was the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Because violence is cyclical. Abuse is cyclical. Harassment. All of these things. And why are they cyclical? Well, because the behavior works.
Yeah, right.
It's learned behavior.
And it does.
Somehow, those feelings of powerlessness that the people feel are getting massaged somewhat through these actions, until they force them to spiral even deeper into feelings of shame and despair and guilt, which only makes them feel less lovable and therefore more powerlessness. And then, guess what? They have to
go back.
Not only go back to the act, but they now have to enhance the act. Okay. They have to elevate.
At which point it becomes, that's when it starts becoming above the waterline, as well.
When there is a batterer, an abusive husband, a physical batterer, there were cycles of abuse long before that person ever hit anyone.
Right.
Cruelty in so many different ways. And so the cycle constantly repeats, but gets more and more intense. And so that's something to keep in mind, that you know, not only are rarely these things lied about, but in fact, there is so much fear about reporting any of them.
Right.
Maybe because we live in a culture where you're going to be called a liar and a slut, or
absolutely,
you're going to be misbelieved. And then the other thing about this is, of course, as we've talked, we talk about in The Truth Is Out There, that when there has been real trauma, the least reliable reporter of what has taken place is the person who was on the receiving end of the most traumatic incident.
Right.
It's why children in child abuse and molestation cases do not make good witnesses, because so many of the details seem to be made up or seem to be
fantastical.
Because especially children, the trauma has been so great, and they don't have the years of experience of life to try to put it into some kind of context.
Right.
So they are authoring a story with it as best they can just to get through the night.
Yeah, right.
And so they're not reliable reporters. They're not reliable witnesses.
Hmm.
And we will respond to that by disbelieving, by rejecting.
Right.
Instead of taking in what is being offered to us and recognizing trauma has taken place. And our response to it is to be a good witness to that, to recognize the truth, and then say, okay, where can we lead with this? What seeds can we plant? What help can we maybe find for the person? Instead of approaching it like a crime or approaching it like a juror
right.
in a jury box.
And lies and no lies. Yeah.
Instead of embracing the person as a fellow human being and recognizing emotional, perhaps psychological, perhaps physical trauma has taken place with this. So the first gift you can believe you can offer people in the holidays and all year round,
all year round.
Is that simple gift of believing
right
people. And that, again, gets back to really kind of the gift in the truth is out there.
Isn't yeah. that true? Well, let's hear a commercial for The Truth Is Out There.
The name of our film is...
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
Join Dean Haglund from The X-Files as he tries to learn what it means to search for the truth in a world where conspiracies or conspiracy theories are everywhere.
Nobody knows how to get out of the trouble we're in because nobody understands how it works.
And I can't learn it because...
You're never going to learn.
Unless I go to your website.
truth-is-out-there.com.
And we're back.
I can't believe we have another half of a show after all that.
That seemed like an epic show in its own right.
I'm ready for a glass of wine.
Ah, we should have eggnog.
It was tough, you know, when I first started doing this work, when I was going through the state accreditation training as a violence prevention specialist, I would come home and, you know, be sort of shell-shocked. It was like everywhere I look, oh my God, there's violence, there's abuse, there's like, and also to recognize I'm them.
Yeah.
I could not look at a perpetrator honestly and not say, you know,
yeah,
I'm not that person. It's
right.
there, but for the grace of God, or whoever you might there
be
I go,
talking
offending
about
our atheist friends again. I'm sorry, Mr. Hitchens.
Why do you do that?
It's a turn of phrase.
Exactly.
That's what I mean. But I simply considered myself lucky
yeah.
to have been able to learn different choices. And it really felt like luck.
Right.
And so it was kind of hard for a while. And then when you start to, again, realize, okay, it is part of all of us. It is part of society. And again, there's no need to victimize someone who has endured this. This
right.
is why we don't think of them as victims, because we're only keeping them in victim.
Right.
We are now victimizing.
Right,
them.
Exactly. Same, the perpetrating
instead
that same.
Of, so instead of looking at them like less than.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of looking at them like these people who have had this happen to them, instead look at them for the heroic people that they are
right.
and look at what they're fighting for.
Right,
look
and at, what look they have accomplished from that.
Thus far, and what they're going to accomplish.
Right. Exactly.
And not only bear witness, but encourage them. And so that was one of the things that started to see me out of it. But boy, it is really, there are some times, you know, and there would be some times speaking to groups of kids where you come home totally charged up going, whoa, boy, I really planted seeds today. And then other times when they were all just locked up, and you had to do the same thing. Like, I planted seeds today. I don't know. Because it is just identifying with the role that you want to play.
Right.
Those days I felt good because, hey, I'm Johnny Appleseed. Other days I wanted to identify with it. Didn't work out the way I wanted it to.
Ah, interesting.
Both those ways, it had to work out exactly how they needed it to.
Exactly.
You know, this 26-year-old who opens fire on pedestrians and on automobile drivers in Hollywood, maybe it was the breakup with the girlfriend of 4 years that this 26-year-old could not handle, given the fact that he was living in someone else's place.
Right.
Without a job, knew no one.
Right.
He was cast adrift. Maybe that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's kind of, you can see why it might be, because he lost every single bit of identity that he held on to.
Right.
All his relevancy that he believed in was gone, and no one was there to tell him, wait a minute, you don't have a place of your own, you don't have a job, you don't have a girlfriend, good for you.
I know, you're
everything
free,
everything is new again.
Exactly,
everything is possible.
Start afresh with a world of possibilities.
And there was no voice in there
right
when darkness fell for that. And so in many ways it does come back to that, to not being able to let go. Because what makes you feel more powerless than losing your relevancy, than losing that identity you want so much. You get fired, it makes you feel powerless, because what am I without this job?
Right.
What am I without my girlfriend? What am I without my kids? What?
Yes,
and that's the question.
That is the question.
The question and the fun is to, if we can, dive headfirst into not knowing what we are, but to know, guess what? I'm going to maybe find out what I am.
Exactly. And don't identify what you do with who you are. Yeah. That has been, you know, the thing of actors that we had learned since theater school. It's like, you know what? The jobs are going to come and go. And if you identify what you do to who you are.
This is why I always say that acting is sacred. And you always go, oh, no, it's not. No, this is the two reasons fundamentally that you cannot argue with me that it is sacred.
It's
is that
sacred.
Actors show for the rest of us two things. One, how to let go of roles once we've played them, whether we played them well or whether we did not play them to the best of our ability, whether we were miscast in them.
Right.
How to let them go, because we've got to get ready for the next role.
Yeah.
We've got to open up for the next role. Actors show us how to do that. They show us the danger of identifying with the roles that we play.
Right.
Humphrey Bogart went... what was supposedly a lovely man until he started to drink, at which point he began to believe he was Humphrey Bogart. That's a
right.
great story about it. How many actors start to identify with the roles that they play? Some say this about Reagan, right?
Yeah.
So that's one reason in which it is sacred for what it demonstrates to us.
Hmm.
But the other thing is actors know something that the audience often to this day chooses not to let interfere with their enjoyment of a work.
Ah.
But that is, the actors aren't making up the words that they're saying. The actors didn't write the part.
Right.
They aren't even directing the piece.
Right.
They are simply playing the part.
Serving
and,
the
and
piece.
You know what? None of us wrote the parts we play. None of us are directing the parts we play. We are all just the ones playing them. And if we get really good at being a witness, we're also the one that gets to
enjoy
be
the show.
An audience
right.
to those roles we are called upon to play.
Look at that. Now there's a Christmas gift. Huh?
So we have kind of inadvertently talked about some of our favorite things,
yes,
especially
absolutely.
As they relate to Truth Is Out There. What are do you have anything that stands out as
well?
Well,
you know,
favorite?
I believe, and we'll explore this in our show next week about our... look back at our New Year's resolutions, but I recall saying I would like an art show, and I had two this year, and they were spectacularly one of my favorite experiences thus far. One here in Los Angeles and the other in Springville, New York, and having an art show was a lot of fun.
That was one of your favorite...
moments.
What was your favorite moments about it? Yeah,
in the art show itself, I think it had to do with here in Los Angeles, it was the art gallery in the Eastern Columbia. So a lot of the neighbors that I see many a time had a variety of curious and delightful reactions to my work, which you could see at deanhagler.com, by the way. And, you know, some of them included, hey, you have a sick mind. Like, you know, hey, neighbor, you're sick. Well, thank you very much. And it's great talking to you, too. And other people, like, really delved into, you know, specific pieces. Some resonated more with others that I was surprised to see. And it was kind of cool that the community that can foster from just expressing one's own, you know, putting up a couple paintings, basically. And then from that, all of these discussions, and you get to know everybody in your building just a little bit better.
I had a favorite moment of 2011 that took place at an art
is that right?
Exhibit. It was at the Tate Modern.
Oh, yes.
I went to see an art exhibit when we were there for the world premiere of Truth Is Out There.
Yeah.
And this is what's amazing about it, is I can't even tell you off the top of my head right now who I went to see.
What?
Do you remember who it was? I remember talking about one room, and it was one of my favorite artists. And
oh,
I
went it wasn't into, the porcelain sunflower seeds on
no,
the floor.
No, and I went into one of the rooms where there were all these colors, then just with a little abstract line kind of drawn through it, like someone had done a little chalk.
Oh,
line.
Yeah.
One of my favorite artists, I don't even remember off the top of my head, because the indelible moment for me, I just had an hour to go and check this out before going to meet you and Natalie and John. And, you know, and so... You know, I was just strolling through this, but kept passing by and making meaningful and significant eye contact with Saffron Burroughs.
Oh, that's right.
Gorgeous. I mean, so tall and so willowy.
The actress.
And just so beautiful. And I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, were circumstances different, she would have felt the full weight of Phil Larenas' charm. And I may not have made it to dinner.
Oh, is that right?
Many circumstances would have needed to be different for that to happen. But I
universe.
Was so just delighted, even in the moment of
Saffron Burroughs.
No, you. I'm in London.
Yes.
To see...
artwork at the Tate Modern.
Well, no, I'm in London... for the world premiere of a film
right.
that I've made.
Yeah.
I think our previous show that we had recorded in Los Angeles had been with Gary Anthony Williams.
Yes.
Because we'd pre-recorded a whole bunch of shows. And that was the most recent one we had pre-recorded.
Uh-huh.
And I travel all the way to that part of the world, show this film. How cool is that? I have an hour. I'm just going to go see great art. And there is one of Gary's co-stars from Boston Legal.
Right.
And you know, I'm not gonna lie to you. I mean, she was punching my clock so hard her fist must have been wrapped in a towel. And there was just something very incredibly kind of romantic.
Did you talk? You didn't even talk.
We said more with our.
Okay, so your deluded fantasy in the Tate Modern.
There was just something so wonderfully... There was. It was just such a great moment, you know? So anyway, that was one of my favorites.
Okay, so your creepy stalking adventure was... that's awesome.
Well, no, I'm always... Oh. I always love just these men, women, children, whatever. I love when I find myself someplace pursuing just my own... enjoyment of
right.
something. My own enjoyment of not only making films, but certain kinds of films and asking certain questions leads me to show the film there, which leads to the opportunity of going to see this art that I enjoy, if ever so briefly, that logic might tell me didn't make sense because I didn't have enough, quote-unquote, time
right.
to go and do
it right. Logical. The
but
Tate
why
Modern's
not
huge.
Just have a few moments with
a couple
it
pieces
while it's there? There's
yeah.
the opportunity. And then to see someone who I really adore and find so attractive. And I have this experience other times. One of my other favorites was to be in the audience at my dear friend Neil Dixon's one-man monologue show,
right.
The Standard Bearer. Got great reviews, directed by Julian Sands.
Right.
And this was the second time I was seeing it. I got off a plane from London, went straight to the airport to see it the first time.
Straight to the theater.
Yeah, straight to the theater.
Yeah.
And this was many, many months later, and boy, the work had evolved. But... and it's got great reviews. Huge rave in the LA Times. And I figure, okay, well, you know, now people will really go to see it. Instead, there's 15 of us in the audience to see it this night. And I'm standing there afterwards talking about theatrical superstitions with Neil.
Yeah.
And with Jared Harris.
Uh-huh.
Madman.
Madman, yeah.
And Moriarty in the current Sherlock
Holmes.
Current
thing, yeah.
And an actor who... may have played the saint on television.
What?
And a certain famous spy in a later thing.
Roger
in a
Moore?
Tweet, in a tweet, Neil Dixon talked about what a great show it had been. In attendance were a saint, a madman, and Phil Larenas. Good company indeed.
Good company
and one of my
indeed.
Favorite moments. And it's all just, and I. These are the moments that I love the best. This is the thing, rather than the scary stalking story. But just how pursuing, no matter how inconvenient it might seem, just my own real enjoyment and admiration for something leads to these encounters with other beings that I have so much innate fondness for, whether I've met them or not.
Right.
And it's just kind of these signposts that are like the universe winking at me, telling me, yeah, see, keep this up.
Ah, see?
Keep this up. They're like the, I equate them to Peter Falk, spoiler alert, in Wings of Desire.
What?
They're the angels that are, Saffron Burroughs was one of my own personal angels winking at me, letting me know
see?
That, yeah, you're on the path that's been being laid out for you.
You are the performer in your own movie.
Ah. And I'm now getting to be an audience to it.
That's right. Fantastic. Well, that's lovely. Because, you know, I guess that's the thing is who do you get to hang with? And for me, I guess it was fun to, after 10 years of just a couple of emails here and there, finally get together with the Lone Gunman in Australia. That happened in October of this year, where both Tom Braidwood and Bruce Harwood and I were all at the same convention, Armageddon Con, in Melbourne, Australia. And I dragged them up on stage and we improvised a lovely episode of Lone Gunman. And I forgot how fun those guys are and how great it was to be on that show. You know, it's kind of like, oh, it only lasted one season, and you can get, you know, bitter and angry about it. But then it was also like, hey, we got to all hang out together, do your own series, and do 10 years on The X-Files, man. You know, when you celebrate it from that angle, it was a joy again to see them and be reminded of all of that.
Plus, I don't think you have to hold down that point of bitterness when you know that Bruce is going to do it for you.
Ow. Ouch. Is he holding that down? I guess so. I don't know. He's not.
He's cantankerous a little bit.
He's always been cantankerous.
I mean, I feel like he and I hit it off like gangbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think we both kind of have that.
that cantankerous.
I have this, anyway. I want to direct him in something someday, but anyway.
I don't know why you don't. You two should.
So, yeah, that's, you know, I look forward to, I guess this will be a favorite of 2012.
Okay.
But I look forward to getting to be in studio with Alex Lefchuk on the midweek drive.
Uh-huh.
Someday, because one of my favorite things of 2011 has been, you know, my regular appearances on on the Midweek Drive.
Of which I've been a guest on.
Just this feeling of kind of connection and community with this group of people in a part of the United Kingdom where I have never visited.
Where are they?
Lincolnshire.
Lincolnshire, oh yeah.
University of Lincoln.
Oh yeah, yeah, of course.
And I can't wait to
go out there.
But it's so much fun. It's a little bit like, it feels like a little bit home from home.
I know. And it's ironic that he's the interrupter to you as you are the interrupter to me.
Wow.
See what I did?
He's the host and he's...
And you're a co-host.
He's not happy about the reputation he's gotten.
About being an interrupter.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I think it was Ulrika, actually.
Oh, who slammed him.
Who slammed him. Who, by the way, is responsible for another one of my favorites of 2011. I don't play favorites among listeners.
Of course
you know
not.
This.
No.
I love all my children
equally.
I just love some more equally than others.
I don't know what that means.
But she, Ulrika's one of our most loyal listeners and so smart and interesting and easy on the eyes. And anyway, you can't say enough good things about Ulrika, responsible for one of my favorite moments of 2011, which was just driving through rainy Vancouver, listening to a mix CD of Rainy Berlin she had made and gifted me on my birthday the year before. And this was on my birthday this year.
A year
later, I'm listening to that CD and it fits the mood perfectly for me. I'd listened to it before, but it was just I brought some CDs along because you never know if a rental car is going to have the auxiliary plug
thing.
For the iPod
whatever.
So I just brought some CDs and I brought the mixes that she had made.
No, I was in the car with you. I don't remember hearing any of the mixes.
You were sleeping. You fell asleep in the back seat.
That's right.
On the way up. Until we got to the border, and then we kind of shut off the music as we were heading into Vancouver and dealing with the traffic. But then it was over the next couple days, you know, driving in the rain.
All right,
all around there, and then coming to pick you up to get the hell out of Dodge.
Get the hell out of Dodge.
Anyway,
that's awesome.
My favorite.
So theoretically, if I slept through that CD, it's in my subconscious somewhere that I can enjoy.
It planted seeds,
as it does.
That's any fantastic. Other favorites?
I traveled a lot this year, more than...
What year don't you?
Well, there's going to be a year where I don't, frankly, because it's getting a little much. But going to Brussels, I think, this year and seeing our good friend Linda in Den Bosch, which is different than Den Bosch, that I found out the hard way.
Not one of your favorite things.
Actually, oh. I got to say, it turned out to be one of my favorite moments, getting lost in... in Central Europe. I don't know if I technically I didn't get lost. To explain this properly, I went online in London to buy a ticket to Den Bosch. Uh-huh. is the capital of one of the provinces in the Netherlands. And the way I spelt it actually got me to a small town just outside of Brussels, which in fact was called Den Bosch, de Kapel. And I didn't realize the two were different. And I thought, hey, it's a 20-minute train ride from Brussels all the way to the Netherlands, when in fact it's a 4-hour train ride. Hilarity ensued. But what it pointed out was both my girlfriend and I are flexible travel partners, and don't let these kind of things stress us out. So we had a good laugh at the platform as we went back to Brussels and got the proper train ticket to get to the Netherlands. Because I should have realized I was not in the town I was in, or I should have been, when I didn't even pass Antwerp. You know, you really should go through Antwerp to get anywhere to the Netherlands out of Brussels or out of Belgium.
So that adventure,
that adventure, really, yeah. You would think it's a disaster.
Where things were going wrong,
and yet it was an enjoyable time.
Yeah,
is that weird?
Because it's not possible for things to go wrong.
It's only not to go as you preconceived it.
Right. To let go again of, you know, to be okay, embracing what is fundamentally true all the time,
absolutely,
which is we are powerless.
That's true. And I must say, Den Bosch in Belgium looks like a lovely town.
And it is absolutely true that if you can embrace that fundamental truth that we are always powerless, then to really enjoy it, to embrace that, is to become powerful beyond measure.
Right.
Because you then are equipped to navigate no matter where the current may lead.
Ah.
And that's really
the Christmas message that we need to challenge.
I don't know if it's a Christmas message. Sort of a different example of that for me is, you know, we did so many Q&As.
Yes, we did.
This year. And one of my favorite moments was born out of one of the oddest moments that we had, which was in our very first Q&A once the film was finished.
All right.
In the United Kingdom, when we got a question that never quite got understood,
right,
asked at the very end of the Q&A.
Yes, that was supposed to be very quick.
And it became a little bit like big time wrestling in the sides against sides, brother against brother, people picking up. Anyway, and it led to me being able to have a much more quiet, meaningful discussion outside afterwards.
Well, I signed autographs,
and I received a lovely gift.
Did you?
From the very person who seemed to be either upset with us, with me, with us,
with us,
or according to some, attacking us, or just, you know, through the whole misunderstanding. And she was lovely. And so I got this gift that's still up in my place. And I look at it. And every time I look at it, I'm
reminded of.
It's a picture, a frame picture of her guru. And
see?
So it's things don't go wrong.
They just don't go as you expect.
Right.
Right. And that's never wrong. That's removing the judgment of right or wrong.
Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean I'm not out to get
you. You are out to get you. You are your own worst enemy. That's awesome. Well, I there's so many more. I mean, you know what else I enjoyed?
What?
Breaking Bad. Let's just take a moment.
I love that you brought that up, because here we're talking about people's heroic journeys and everything. Why did you enjoy Breaking Bad? You know why I loved it? I loved it for the villain.
The villain. So good.
Did you see that Stephen King wrote that Gus Fring, played by Giancarlo Esposito, the best villain in the history of television?
Oh, yeah. And it's true.
Yeah.
Because you learn so much from him. I think it's fantastic that here, Vince Gilligan, who wrote The Gunman, good friend, has done what any writer, you know, I think it used to be that you wanted to lock away and write the great American novel. But now I think the way has changed is you'd want to write the great American television series. And I think he's done that. This incorporates our education system and teachers being underfunded, are the way the American healthcare system works, that you are desperate to, if you have cancer, to pay for that, that you would resort to making crystal meth in order to pay for, you know, think about the motivations that started the whole ball rolling, was that he is an underpaid school teacher who gets cancer, who then, because of the health system, has to go to extreme measures to pay for that.
And what is cancer, and what are the causes of it, and what do we mean by it? I mean, it becomes very interesting.
And it becomes a metaphor then throughout the whole...
And there is absolutely no avoiding the reality at this point of what Vince told us years ago after season one. You know,
yeah,
he
it's true.
Whispered to us. And that is that, you know, Walt, the main character... He's the cancer.
Right. He's the cancer in the family, in the community, in the entire thing at large. And it just, it was so, not just meticulously done and carefully done, but there was also this sense of joy of each episode being, you know, crafted to its finest sheen, and that it reverberated in so many different levels that I just loved and then loved watching, even though it made me cringe, even though I, you know, there were some episodes that were like, oh, they've gotten so dark, how are they going to top that? And they did. That was the thing. It was fantastic.
I felt very much the same way about Justified this year.
Oh, is that right?
I loved having a hero that I could love. I loved having villains I could love. I loved having, you know, actors getting their best roles of their careers and being discovered for the first time, and, you know, being discovered overnight after 30 years of nonstop work.
Right.
In another very believable setting that's unlike the one I live in, and also knowing that it's so funny and cool and action packed. And
okay,
season three is starting in January.
It is. Can I pick it up at season three, or do I have to get two and one and two?
If you miss season two, you're missing the most fun television that maybe was ever on television.
Hmm.
If you start with season one, you may want to give up after half the season, which is what I did, what other people have done.
Right.
And I picked up season two because friends of mine were in it. And the leap between season one and season two, fans of Parks and Recreation...
love Justified?
No, say that this is true of Parks and Rec.
Oh, is that right?
That a show that was a wreck in season one became Parks and Rec in season two.
See, I never got past season one. Yeah, that's why I never...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like Parks and Rec as much as the next person, unless the next person likes it. And... So what I ended up doing, which was really an incredibly fun thing to do, I would pair up season two with season one, and I would go an episode of season two and then go back to an episode of season one and make it all the way through that way, which was super cool. But definitely watch season two. You don't need to
see season one.
But you will find that you want to go back to season one because... Once you fall in love with the whole thing, then what does work about season one is enough to keep you hooked, especially because you know it's going to a place where it's fantastic.
Oh,
and one of the reasons for it is I think they upped the budget enough on season two where they could go outside of L.A. to make the show. So you can believe in locale.
Right.
There's something undercutting... the authenticity of the show when, for example, you'll recognize locations that are supposed to be in the hills of Kentucky and they're right around from where your old house was.
Yeah, is that
you
right?
know, and that undercuts the authenticity of it. Yeah. But also I felt like that undercut kind of the authentic effort that was being given by everyone.
Right.
Like, well, there's no way we can pull this off. In the same way.
No one's gonna buy it.
It's a TV show.
Right.
We'll make a TV show.
Interesting.
And then it became something more than that.
Wow.
So that was a lot of fun.
That is fun. And of course, I have a Christmas gift for you.
Should I open it now? Should you're telling people where they can find
every
episode?
You can find every episode, of course, at our website, which is chillpackhollywood.com, spelled C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. You can also find us on Facebook, where you can be a liker of the show and contact us and be part of the community. And Phil is opening first the Christmas card that came. That's to both you and your significant other. A lovely...
Oh, it's a painting of... Dean's Dobermans, Mila and Akasha, and it's from Mila, Akasha, Patty, Dean, and the entire Rational Exuberance
staff
team. Mila's saying, maybe we should stay off the naughty list next year, and Akasha's saying, speak for yourself.
Yes, and you see her foot's in the gift there, and they tore up everything.
And you know... Naughty, nice.
I know. It's all right.
You're just in the top two one way or another.
See that.
Oh, and that's very sweet.
See that.
Happy holidays, dear Phil. You were my favorite of 2011.
I didn't write that. Oh, but I might as well have. Yes. So the box is...
Bit... You didn't... Facebook.com / Chillpack
Hollywood. Yes. And of course, you can download us on iTunes. You can stream us every show. We're putting up old shows as well. And you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at D. Haglin. And Phil is at Phil Lairness. Full word. This is something for you to take to
Dragon. People listen to us on Jackalope Radio.
Oh, Jackalope Radio, yes.
They
and
listen to
us at Talk Superstation.
TalkSuperstation.com.
Yes, they can hear you on the Drive 107.3.
Midweek Drive. Midweek every week, 107.3 Siren FM.
That's right.
SirenOnline.co.uk. And then in podcastable version on Southside Broadcast.
Ah, see.
It was great. They introduced me a couple weeks ago. And said, right before bringing me on, and saying, and of course now, it's our Paul Weller moment. Introducing me with Paul.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Well, this is a little something to go with your future plans.
Oh, my goodness. This is hilarious. This is hilarious. If you could see what I'm holding, you would know that I've got steampunk goggles. The word is out.
The word is out. You are
my
destined.
Collection has been growing these last couple months. I've been getting accessories.
Have you? You don't have a pair of goggles like this.
Oh, not like this.
Right.
I have another pair.
To go on the bowler hat.
I have another pair. Well, I now have another hat,
oh,
too.
Oh, you do.
Where, yeah.
Okay.
And the other pair of goggles I have... is the one with the different
magnifying lenses. We saw that one too.
So I've got quite a few different possibilities now.
You know, we're going to get you then next year is the Star Trek communicator, but instead of a communicator, it's got a little Morse code ticker on it.
Ooh.
But it's the Star. So you like, it's a steampunk Star Trek mash.
Oh,
yeah.
I love it because as I'd said, at the age of 50, I may very well give myself over entirely.
I think you
to
should.
To steampunk. Of course, at 60, I'll be giving myself over entirely to wizard wear.
Until then. Have merry holidays.
Thanks for being with us all year long. And you know what? One last thing. We've gone well over, but over at the blog on MySpace, I've listed and thanked all the people who were guests on the show this year. So if you haven't done so, please check out the blog at myspace.com/chillpackhollywood to remind yourself of some of the fabulous guests we've had. And there are links there to their shows that they did with us.
Fantastic. Till then.
Till next year.
I'm Dean Haglin.
I'm Phil Lairness.